If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming, the pirates are coming, the pirates are coming, you better watch out.
Arr.
It's Space Pirate Radio times, everyone. Another Wednesday evening, November the 2nd, 2016, 9 o'clock in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, also known universally, it's November the 3rd, 2016 at 1 o'clock in the morning. Last show for our daylight savings time, so next week we will be on standard time. That will be 2 o'clock universal time, so keep that in mind to tune in a little bit earlier, is it? Later. Well, whatever works out for you. Don't forget, we have our chat room open for you. Come on in, join the crew. We've got me and you and Plaid Joan, Glenn, Plaid Mac, Optronics, Sister Plaid. And we have a guest tonight, Jerry Hubble from Explore Scientific, if you're that extra R in the beginning there. Hey, Jerry, how you doing?
Good. I'm doing great, Marty. I appreciate coming on tonight. I've got a lot to talk about.
Excellent. Always glad to have you here. So we will skip our usual astronomical events tonight, or get to them a little bit later. We'll see what happens. And we'll just kind of wing it, see how much we got to go over. Just a couple of things, not much on the sun. Got some novas in the Scorpius Sagittarius region. And, of course, nice low, southern low planets for us though here in the northern hemisphere. So we'll talk about those a little bit later. Let's get on to you, Jerry. You've been really busy this past year.
Yeah, I've been, I'm blessed to be able to go to some star parties this summer in California. I went to, started out with the RTMC, the Riverside Telescope Makers Conference in Big Bear City, California. And that was, that's the first time I'd been there. Mm-hmm. And it's a great location. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a beautiful sight. It's up around 6,500 feet, and it's just gorgeous up there. It reminded me of the, you know, when I was a kid in the 70s, you know, these trips that the Brady Bunch took to go camping.
Uh-huh.
The pine trees and all that. It was just like that. I mean,
just like those plastic. Like those plastic pine trees that the Brady Bunch camped around.
Right, exactly. It was just gorgeous. Yeah. But it was a great time up there. I don't know if your audience knows, I'm with Explore Scientific. I'm the director of electrical engineering. We've got a couple of new products we've announced this year. The one that I've been working on the last 3 years or so is the telescope, not the telescope drive master, it's the mount controller PMC-8. And I have worked on the telescope drive master, but that was previous to this. And but the PMC-8 is a brand new mount controller that we've released. If you've seen ads in Sky and Telescope magazine, you'll see what it's all about. And we got to show that off to quite a few people up in RTMC. Then I went to the next star party I went to was in Beaver, California. It was a Golden State star party. That's a gorgeous location. Also, 80 miles from Mount Shasta, but you can see it on the horizon. Ooh. Sticks right up out of the ground.
That sounds great.
You can just about touch it. You know, it's amazing.
So you're into some of the dark sky areas of California.
Absolutely. It was dark. I mean, it was so dark when the Milky Way came up and all the stars came up. We just had a heck of a time trying to locate our alignment stars. It was just that's the first time I'd ever run into that. It was just amazing.
Yeah, that's a problem I've had up in Canada. Yeah.
Too many stars and they kind of blend together, so you lose the constellations.
Yep. And actually, I think it was there when I saw when it was right after twilight, when the Milky Way was really bright, you know, when your eyes got adapted really good. I came out of the little trailer that Scott and Greg have been towing around and looked at the horizon. I saw some clouds and I said, "What?" And I asked Greg, "What are those? Is it getting cloudy?" He says, "No, that's the Milky Way."
Yeah.
Dummy, you know, it's like, don't you know what the Milky Way looks like? So, you know.
Did you get some zodiacal light also? Did you notice?
No, I know some couple people talked about it. What was it? I can't remember now, but I think people were looking for that. Maybe it was in the last Star Party when we were in Washington State up in Oroville. At the Table Mountain Star Party, that was a gorgeous location too,
mm-hmm.
And it was a up next to the Canadian border in Ooh. Washington State.
Love it.
So those are the three Star Parties I went to.
Excellent. I haven't been to a big Star Party in a long time. I need to get back into doing that. Some traveling again.
So as far as these Star Parties, Jerry, are these all open to members of the public?
Some. You have to pay to get into these, but registration. I think anybody can register to go. I believe that's the case for all three of those shows.
Out of the three, are there any that you'd particularly recommend for, say, newcomers or people who are not so experienced with Star Parties? Like, if somebody were to say, hey, I've never been to a Star Party and I want to see a true dark sky in the company of astronomers, would any of those take preferences that this would be a good introductory Star Party for somebody who's never done it before?
I think, in regards to the easiest to get to, the one in Big Bear and you know, in Los Angeles area, there's a huge population there. If anybody, I think that would probably be the best one for anybody to get to that's the easiest. It's the shortest drive, you know. So Big Bear is a good location for beginners. We had quite a few beginners at all the Star Parties, first time they'd ever been there. So that was gratifying to see, you know, even beginning people that just started learning the sky were there. So I think any of them would be good. I think the easiest one to get to would probably be the one at RTMC. And then probably the next one, well, the other two, in Beaver, California, is up in the northeastern corner of California. It was a 4-hour drive north from Reno, where I flew into. And it's out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, absolutely nowhere. But it's ranch country up there. They do cattle ranching up there, and it's a great location.
But it's definitely a time investment, then.
It takes a while to get there, right?
And these are whole weekend-long Star Parties, basically.
Yes,
activities going on during the daytime.
Right. RTMC is just the Memorial Day weekend. Is it Memorial Day? It's in May, the end of May. That's a 3-day event. The one in Beaver, California, Golden State Star Party, starts earlier, like a Thursday in the week, and it goes for like 4 or 5 days. And then Table Mountain Star Party was actually the longest one I went to. That was like 6 days. It goes from like Tuesday all the way to the end of the, you know, the beginning of the next week.
So that was the one that you said was fairly close to the Canadian border,
right?
Washington State. How far would that be from, say, Seattle?
Well, I flew into Spokane, so it was closer to Spokane than it was to Seattle. So, and it was a 4-hour drive from Spokane up north, northwest direction. So it's kind of in the middle of the, you know, you got the width of the state on the map. It's kind of in the middle at the border. It's only 5 miles from the border.
Anything extra special you saw at these things, either up in the skies or equipment-wise or anything, or people? Or
well, the these are somewhat smaller Star Parties.
Mm-hmm.
Not real big ones like the Texas Star Party, I think, is probably bigger. And then, of course, you got the big shows like NEEF and all that have all the equipment vendors come. But there was a few, you know, RTMC used to be bigger. It used to be one of the largest, if not the largest, Star Party in the country at one point. And they had tons of vendors. Mm-hmm. But the vendor count's been going down over the years, I guess over the couple of decades. But there was probably 10 to 15, 20 vendors there.
Okay.
And the attendance was probably 300 to 500, somewhere around that range. And people were there to camp out, you know, and mm-hmm. stay there for a few days. So that's how those went. But the Milky Way was the star of the show when I was there with the dark skies. I mean, it was just gorgeous. And it's amazing when you get a truly dark sky like that, how well adapted your eyes get to where you can walk around. It's almost like the Milky Way is casting a shadow.
Uh-huh.
It's like the full moon being out. You're walking around, you can see everything, you know.
It's hard to see something in front of you on the ground, but if you have the sky as a background, it kind of makes everything silhouetted.
Well, that's what I noticed. Yeah, I noticed that too. When you look up towards the horizon, up into the sky, you see the tree line very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you know the sky. Your eyes are adapted because you can see that clearly. Like you said, you can't see the ground when you're walking around. You got to watch how you're walking. But when you're looking up, you can see everything.
Any unusual telescopes?
There was a large dob, a 40-inch.
Oh.
Let's see if I can recall.
Commercial scope?
I can't remember. No, it was a homemade.
Mm.
Believe it or not.
And it was portable?
It was, well, he had it on a truck, I think.
Wow.
But that was in Bieber.
Somebody was offering a 40-inch telescope commercially. I can't remember who that was.
I didn't get a chance to look for that. Yeah.
That would be nice to get 40-inch, but they're pretty pricey, even for, you know, mirror and a strut dot. Still really expensive.
Yeah, I think he built the telescope, but he didn't build the mirror. I think he mm-hmm. bought the mirror somewhere, but put the rest of it together. And there was another scope that we saw in RTMC that was really gorgeous. It was a size of 12-inch refractor.
Mm-hmm.
It was on this gorgeous mount that was homemade. It looked like all CNC, all handmade. The control system on it was just had, you know, it wasn't it was electronic, but it wasn't like computerized. It was all hand switches and dials and things. It was cool looking. I don't know if I think I did take some pictures of it. I don't know if I've got them on my phone here. I think I'll try to find it here maybe and send it to you.
All right, we can put it in our chat room, too.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? Oh, well.
I was going to ask, Jerry, if there were any special objects that you viewed at any of these parties. Anything that particularly stood out as being remarkable and certainly not something you could do from your home observing site.
The Milky Way in general, but unfortunately, the weather was moving through a couple of nights that we were able to see. Or when it was clear, but the weather was moving through and the wind was picked up quite a bit on even, I think, Bieber and the RTMC and then Bieber. And the seeing was not the best.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, I would say I was there, you know, over the summer. I spent like 13 nights, I think, at star parties. And probably we only had good seeing for like maybe 3 or 4 nights out of that. But Mars, we'd look at Mars. We looked at, and it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time it was just an orange smudge.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time, unfortunately, I didn't get a lot of time to do any personal observing. I was talking to customers practically the whole time, showing off our system. And everybody else was getting to look through. And we were just kind of demonstrating the mount more than looking at any objects. But I was able to, we were able at Bieber and at the Golden State Star Party, probably around 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning, we got our system tuned up really well. We were just hopping the sky, all the Messier objects, going through them one after the other. And we probably looked at 25, 30 of them all in a row, like in an hour and a half or something like that. And our system was working great. It was going from one target to the next. Like we'd spend 2, 3, 4 minutes looking at each one. And so for me, I used to be a big visual guy, but not. It's been a long, long time. So that was the first time I'd ever really, in probably 20, 25 years, that I had done any Messier object star, you know, hopping around.
Mm.
So that was a good experience there. And it was neat to see that our system was working okay.
I see that Explore Scientific, where you have like Lousmody mounts and stuff like that. Do you have your own mount, or basically you add the extras to it, the controllers?
We're selling the Lousmody G11 with our system on it, the PMC8. Mm-hmm. That's our flagship mount. And then we've got our own mount called the Exos 2 that we're going to sell our system on, the PMC8 with the Exos 2 is going to be sold. And I can give some hints. We've got a couple more mounts that we're going to be offering here soon also that are, you know, the G11 is a fairly heavy mount. We've got a heavier mount that we're looking at releasing here soon. And then we're actually trying to push the technology down as low to the lower end as we can. So our goal is to have a sub-$1,000 mount. And even sub $800 mount, it's going to be performance is going to blow your socks off as far as pointing and guiding and all that stuff.
Now, do you usually use the existing mounts motors or?
No, we replace the motors.
Okay, replace the motors and then all the controllers. As you have drive corrector, something
we
else.
Right, we have the Telescope Drive Master, which is a drive corrector also for the right ascension axis. That's another system that can be added on to like the G11, or if you've got, and you can buy that now for a bunch of different mounts, the EQ6, the Orion Atlas, Celestron, CGE Pro, other Celestron, and even the Mead LX200 mount, and you know, other mounts like from Mead and Celestron. So the Telescope Drive Master, which is a drive corrector, can be put on any of those systems.
So does it make it more controllable, more accurate?
The PMC-8 is a separate control, is a mount controller. That one's very accurate, very highly refined controller. The Telescope Drive Master basically reduces your PE if you're doing astrophotography. Your periodic error in your gears need to be reduced down to less than 1 to 2 arc seconds. So that's what the Telescope Drive Master does, is it has a high resolution encoder to monitor the tracking rate, and it corrects it real time and brings your periodic error down to less than 2 arc seconds, plus or minus 1 arc second.
For people that don't know, when gears mesh together, there can be like slightly high spots and low spots in the gears themselves, which will actually make the mount very, very slightly go a little faster and a little slower. That's called periodic error, and it basically is a constant error as the gears mesh together. One engages, one disengages. So the periodic error corrector basically compensates by changing the speed of the motor. So when the gears want to speed up, the motor slows down. When the gears want to slow down, the motor speeds up. So basically it keeps the turning rate of the drive, the telescope turning, as even as possible. So basically your star doesn't wiggle back and forth, which really shows up when you're taking photographs through the telescope. That's called periodic error.
You ought to be a teacher, Marty. That's great.
I do that.
That's a great explanation. But that's correct. That's exactly what it does. It's like the old-fashioned drive corrector that you used to turn back in the 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. 70s with the AC corrector.
Yep.
With the synchronous motor.
Which you can speed up and slow down depending on the object that you're looking at and how unbalanced your telescope was. So if you have your telescope unbalanced, it tends to make the whole mount go a little faster or a little slower, depending on which way the weights were off.
Yep.
All right.
So that's what the Telescope Drive Master does. The PMC-8 is a whole drive controller that controls the motors to slew and track and point accurately. We've got our own. It's a wireless controller also, so it uses Wi-Fi. You can connect a tablet to it, and we've got an application that we built. And I've wrote the ASCOM driver. There's an ASCOM driver for it also to be able to use that controller with the ASCOM. Any client that you have that uses ASCOM can talk to our controller.
Mm.
So that's available.
So that's a wireless controller for ASCOM users. Is that what you said?
Yeah, it'll talk ASCOM over wireless. So that's one of the first controllers that will do that, internally, as opposed to adding on one of these wireless interfaces to a standard controller that's got a serial port. This is integrated into the controller internal.
I have to check that out for our telescope at work. Let's see. What have we got going here?
Well, Jerry also went on some other adventures this year.
That's right. I went to Arizona for vacation in the dog days of August, which everybody says, you don't want to go to Arizona in August.
Monsoon season. That?
Now, yeah, the surprising thing about this, I live in Virginia, so August... it's terrible a lot of times.
It's hot and humid.
And muggy. It's just awful. And to tell you the truth, when we flew into Phoenix, the first 2 days we were in Phoenix, that was the worst of the whole trip. We were there for 10 days. As soon as we got out of Phoenix and drove north to Flagstaff, we got up into, up a little higher altitude and got up towards the Grand Canyon where it's a little higher altitude. It was gorgeous. It was 75 degrees. And 30% humidity, and got up to maybe 80 degrees the whole rest of the trip, and it was just great. I don't know why anybody would not want to go to Arizona in August. Tucson too was nice.
Oh, you made it as far as Tucson. So
we drove all over. We drove 2,000 miles in 10 days.
Good Lord.
So, but it was small trips during the day. The longest trip was when we. We drove all the way back from Grand Canyon, the South Rim, down to Tucson. That was like a 5-hour trip. We stopped along the way and saw some stuff. But we drove north from Phoenix when we first got there to Flagstaff, and then a couple days, and went up north to the Grand Canyon. Went to Monument Valley also. That's a gorgeous place.
And so just so our listeners don't think that we're working for the Arizona Board of Tourism, of course, Arizona is an amateur astronomer's paradise.
Mm-hmm.
So astronomically speaking, what wonderful things did you get up to?
Well, let me tell you a story about why I wanted to go to Arizona to begin with. I always wanted to go to Flagstaff. And near Flagstaff is Winslow, Arizona, which has Meteor Crater. And since I was a kid, I told you before, I think, that I always liked the moon. I've done high-resolution lunar imaging. I've been in love with the moon since I was the Apollo days. And when I was a kid, the moon was just always special. So I always wanted to visit a crater or see a crater. And I found out about, Meteor Crater when I was a kid. And I always wanted to go there. So I finally got that. And that was the first thing I did when I got to Flagstaff was we drove out to Meteor Crater, and it was just awesome to see this big hole in the ground. And, I could relive my dreams of walking on the moon, standing there next to the crater. That's really the reason I wanted to go to Arizona. That was the whole reason.
Well, it's a wonderful place, so I can totally understand that. I first saw it when I was 7 years old, and it was mind-blowing.
Yeah. And the other thing that struck me is how transparent the air is there. When you look out across the crater, it's a mile across.
Yeah.
And it looks like you could just reach out and touch the other side. I mean, it's like it doesn't look that big, but it is. Mm-hmm. And so that was awesome. So that was a big thing. And then the other, that was a geological, astronomical thing to see, And I'm interested in asteroids, too, so that was another big thing, And that's what slammed into the Earth there.
Would be nice to take a walk down into the bottom of it. I was there 30 years ago, and we couldn't do that. I guess there's kind of a risk of rattlesnakes and things like that.
Yeah, when I was last there in 2009, the winds were so high you couldn't even go out on the observation deck. They had it all basically shut down. Yeah, it was a very windy day.
That'd be more fun.
But I was really impressed with the changes made to the museum between, say, 1988 and 2009. You know, it was much updated, much expanded. So great, great place. What else did you see, Jerry? Because Flagstaff, of course, is the home to many notable observatories.
Right, and one of the biggest is the Lowell Observatory, where I got to visit there. We went there one afternoon when we were in Flagstaff. I think the first day we were there that afternoon, we got there in the morning and then checked into the hotel, and we drove to up on Mars Hill to Lowell Observatory, and they give daily tours there. And we got to hear a talk about the 24-inch Clark refractor, and that's another key thing on my list. I've visited four Clark refractors over the years.
Where?
The first one was the 26-inch Clark refractor at University of Virginia, the
okay.
Leander McCormick Observatory there on campus. I'd visited there first when I was in college. My one of my electrical engineering professors went to UVA, and he actually worked at the observatory, so I got a special tour of that when I was going to college. And then I got to see back in 2009, I think we took a trip to Denver and saw the Chamberlain Observatory has a 26-inch, or no, it's a 20-inch. That's the 20-inch Clark refractor in Denver, Colorado. That's right downtown, and I guess that's University of Denver. Can't remember the school there that runs that observatory. But that was a beautiful scope too. And then I was fortunate enough to be invited to a couple of seminars at the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., and saw the twin to the UVA 26-inch Clark refractor there, and got to observe through that telescope. That was nice. And that was the third one. And then this was the fourth one that I've seen.
Now, I believe that's recently been restored, correct?
Absolutely, yes. And there's a great book on it that I bought. But just last year, I don't know if people recall, 2 or 3 years ago, they sent out a mailing asking for donations to help restore the telescope.
Yep.
And so that was going on probably the last 2 years ago, a year ago. It got finished, I think, last year. They finished it, and it's better than new. Excuse me.
So did you get to look through it?
No, because, excuse me, it was cloudy that day. So I got to stand up next to it and see it, but it's better than new shape. I mean, just to think about this. They took the whole tube assembly, you know, took all the lens out and everything, cleaned it all up. They powder coated the whole thing.
Well,
think about that.
Mm-hmm.
They took it apart and powder coated it. So that's what the finish is on the outside. It's just amazing. And then all the instruments, all the brass instruments, you know, all the brass fittings, the brass the focuser and all that. That's all polished, bright brass. You know, everything is great. It's got a 12-inch. I think it's a 12-inch finder.
Well,
you know, an apochromatic, you know, I don't think it's apo. I think it's just achromatic finder. But it's a gorgeous piece of work there. I mean, and of course, this is the telescope that Percival Lowell started his fantasies with Mars and got everybody convinced that there was life on Mars. And, but he did, I think he did everybody a service because he basically helped invent science fiction, I think.
Yeah.
H.G. Wells. And, you know, so without science fiction, we wouldn't have science fact in a lot of cases, I think. But so he started down that path. And he also was interested in finding Planet X back in the, I think, early 1900s is when people started talking about the ninth planet that was out there that nobody knew about past Neptune. And so he had that dream, but he passed away before he was able to discover it. And then in 1929, Clyde Tombaugh was tasked with trying to find Planet X. And, of course, he found the now demoted planet Pluto.
It's to say, but he only found Pluto instead.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
So, about halfway through our program, let's do a quick station identification. You are...
Arr.
All right. Listen to the Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. It is Wednesday evening, November the 2nd, 2016, a little bit past 9:30 in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. Also known Universal Time is November the 3rd at 1:32 in the morning, Universal Time. So that means you're still listening to us live, and you got us live for another half hour. So come on over and join us at our astronomy.fm chat room, which you can get to the homepage, or just type in astronomy.fm/chat. You'll get to the login. Type in a name and hit login, and you'll be here in the chat room. So if you want to ask Jerry any questions, you can type them in the chat room. Getting other astronomy questions, feel free to do so. Coming up, of course, after Space Pirate Radio, our usual lineup of Astronomy Ireland, Planetary Radio, Naked Astronomer, Naked Scientist, all the usual good stuff following us. And don't forget, we repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So you might catch us a little later in one of the repeats. It's a better time to listen in. Our guest tonight is Jerry Hubble from Explore Scientific, talking about adventures traveling around doing astronomy touristy stuff.
Right.
In the best areas of the country.
Yep. And I've been fortunate. I've been to Tucson in the past. That's that was the last part of our trip was at Tucson, and I had been to the University of Arizona Mir Lab previously, but I didn't go to it this time. But that's a great place to go to if you want.
Yeah, that's on my bucket list. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And so I won't get into that too much. But when we were in Tucson, I actually drove south east of there to a location, Sonoyta, Virginia, Sonoyta, Arizona, which is home to the Winer Observatory, which is run by an early pioneer of remote telescopes, Mark Trueblood. And I don't know if some of you may be familiar with his work, but he wrote a book in the mid-1980s called Microcomputer Control of Telescopes. And that's what got me set on the path of learning how to do the electronics for telescopes. And I got to visit and with him and talk about his observatory. He hosts about, I think he's got 10 professional telescopes in his huge roll-off roof observatory that he hosts there. And he's been running this observatory for 30 years. So he wrote that book, and I brought my copy of his book to him so he could sign it. And he graciously asked for a copy of my book and wanted me to sign it. So that was pretty cool.
Nice.
So I've got a picture of us holding each other's books in front of the observatory. That was cool. So, but he's done a lot of work. He used to work for NASA. He works for the University of Arizona. He's a professional, astronomer, professional instrumentation guy. He's got his PhD in physics and I think something else. So he's a very smart guy.
Well, we got a question here which is going to kind of tie into observatories. We got a question. Do you have a telescope of your own?
I sure do. I've got several telescopes.
The biggest
telescope I have, and we'll get into the observatory I've been working on lately, but the one I personally own, I've got a 10-inch Meade LX. This is an old from 1987, LX5, 10-inch LX5 that I don't use anymore. I've still got that scope, and the biggest scope personally that I use, I'm into refractors, so I've actually got a 6-inch APO refractor, which is the Explore Scientific 152 APO carbon fiber. And that's the biggest telescope I have right now that I use. I do have an 8-inch RC scope, the Astrotech RC, if you're familiar with that one. Mm-mm. It's a carbon fiber tube also, but I don't use that one much anymore either. And then that'll help me. That's a good segue into the Mark Slade Remote Observatory that I've been working on the last year.
Where's that located at?
That's located about 5 miles from my house in Wilderness, Virginia, is the little location, is what it's called. And I've got some good news recently. Finally, we got our, if anybody out there is familiar and do asteroid work, we obtained our Minor Planet Center observatory code just recently for our observatory location. It's Whiskey 54, which is kind of a cool number.
Yeah, that's a really cool name.
Yeah. So W54 is our code, and that allows us now to make observations of asteroids and submit them for posterity, for people to use and for them to update their orbital parameters for all the asteroids. So that's cool. That was a little bit of work. There's a procedure you have to go through. You have to take measurements over a few nights on several different asteroids and then prove that you can, you know, image these objects and calculate their positions accurately enough for them to allow you to submit the observations, accurate observations. So that was a good feather in my cap. And that's actually the second observatory code I've worked on and obtained. The first one was for my own location at my observatory, which was a portable observatory at my home. It wasn't permanent. So I can observe at my house and submit those observations to the Minor Planet Center also.
Is there restrictions on how often to submit? I mean, do you have to submit a minimal amount of observations to them?
No, there's no restrictions or no requirements in that regard. In fact, there's a lot of observatory locations that are not active anymore. They have, so quite a few locations are not as active or not active at all anymore.
Yeah, something I'll consider for the observatory at work.
If you plan on doing asteroid work, what the Minor Planet Center did do, and this is a good interim solution if you're not wanting to go through all the work to get your own code, is they've got a mobile code or a mobile code that you use when you submit observations now.
Okay.
There's no requirement for them to take the observations. They'll either take them or reject them.
Mm-hmm.
Because that you haven't been certified, basically, as far as being able to do it. Now, when you're first starting out, that's a good way to do it, to find out, you know, get practice and find out how to submit observations to the Minor Planet Center and get used to that. That would work for you. And then learn the process. And then at that point, if you want to obtain your own code, then you can go ahead and do that.
Oh, excellent. So I assume that's all on their website?
Yep, exactly. And so I was able to do a lot of observations this past year with the Mark Slade Remote Observatory. Just a quick thing. That observatory was built from equipment that was passed to our club from a former member of the club that passed away last year. He had wanted to build his own permanent observatory. He had bought a lot of equipment. He had this 12-inch Meade LX200 that we're using. He had this Technical Innovation 6-foot dome with the automation, the controller and the automation and everything goes along with it. He had that. He had bought a lot of miscellaneous other pieces of equipment. He had a nice big wedge and a pier that he was going to use to build this thing. But he just, unfortunately, he passed away before he was able to get that done. So we took it upon ourselves, instead of his widow, it thought that she might just sell all the stuff piecemeal out on cloudy nights or something.
Mm-hmm.
But we said, no, we want to build this observatory for Mark. So we went ahead and finished it. We we raised some funds, a couple thousand dollars, and built the facility, the structure of the observatory, put the dome on it, and finished it for them and got it all integrated. And it's actually a remote controlled observatory. I can sit in my house on my big screen TV and run it from my living room.
Nice.
And it works great.
That's fantastic.
Hey, you have a couple of books on how to make your own remote controlled observatories.
Right, exactly. And that's I figured, you know, I wrote this book. It's by Springer, Remote Observatories for Amateur Astronomers. And I figured if people start asking me, do you really know what you're talking about? You know, it sounds good in the book. You read the book and it talks about a lot of stuff and it makes a lot of sense. But have you ever done this? I said, well, yeah, I have. Uh-huh. I built my own telescope systems, you know, integrating a lot of parts. And that was what my previous book was, which is called Scientific Astrophotography. So I learned all about how you build your own telescope system, or I call it an astronomical imaging system in the book. And it takes all the pieces, parts that you can go buy commercially, and integrates it all into the system based on what your needs are for your observing program. So that was the first part of building the observatory, was actually getting all the instrumentation built so that you could take the data. And then the second book was about how you can integrate that AIS into an observatory facility that's permanent and remotely operated. So that's what the second book's about.
So people can find that through Amazon?
You can do a couple ways. You can look on Amazon and look up my name, Hubble, H-U-B-B-E-L-L, and it's under Gerald, G-E-R-A-L-D. Or you can go to Springer and look up my name also, Gerald Hubble, and you'll find my books.
Excellent. Let's see. Talk about Explore Scientific a little bit more.
Yeah, I've been working for Explore for 3 years now. It'll be 3 years in January that I was hired on. I actually started working a few months beforehand as a contractor with Scott, and he wanted me to look at. He wanted to build a new control system for mounts that was just going to blow everybody away, and be cutting edge, use the latest technology, use the latest interface technology with pads and phones and stuff like that, and provide the easiest user interface for beginners that you could ever think of. So that was kind of our goal, and I had started working with there's a fellow named Dan Dickerson who started on the application on that side of it, using the existing JOC go-to control system that they were selling. And we started down that path, getting that application working. And basically it's a touch, you know, it's a pad or a phone, you know, with a screen that's got icons on it. So for example, if you want to go to an object, just for an example, you would bring up a screen that says solar system or Messier, and it would bring up pictures, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then you hit the picture, one touch on the picture, and it would give you a screen that says, this is the object, here's some information about it. You want to go to that object? Yes. And that's all you do, to go to objects.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of simplified interface he wanted for beginners. But behind the scenes, it's also got all this sophisticated alignment, you know, routines, all the other things that go along with making sure the mount points correctly and tracks correctly and all that. So that was the beginning of the system, and I had pitched him a hardware system that uses an 8-processor microcontroller, which is pretty cool. It's got 8 cores in it, and it's a little microcontroller doesn't use interrupts. It's deterministic in its operation, which means each processor in it, it's totally independent of the others. The only thing that it does, if you want to share information amongst the processors, is you write a memory location, and then the other location The other processor reads that. So that's how you share memory, share information between the processors. But this thing is just, you know, totally bulletproof, basically, as far as that, the way it runs. So if one motor fails, it doesn't stop anything else going on. It doesn't hang up the whole system like, you know, on Windows when something hangs up, it hangs up the system. It will never happen on this controller. So it's a real-time instrument. It's not really a general-purpose computer-type controller. So in that regard, it's very robust, very reliable. So that was the start of this control system that I wanted to build for him. So that's what I've been working on the last 3 years. And we finally got it all up and ready to be packaged and be sold, and we've been advertising it in Sky and Telescope for the last few months.
Great. Astrophotography. Do you do some astrophotography? I think, didn't you say on asteroids, but do you other stuff too?
Yeah, I do. Well, when we were the Mark Slade Observatory, we've been testing it also on different things. We've done some deep sky stuff with it. Unfortunately, our funding is such that we don't have the best equipment. We got this old LX200. We got the camera we've been using is an S-Big ST2000, which is about 12 years old. So you can imagine. So basically what we've done is we've taken, and this LX200 scope is almost 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So we've taken all this really old equipment and integrated into a modern remotely operated observatory, which is kind of a feat in itself. We are running into some issues with the mount. We've had some failures with the deck motor running off, you know, by itself, and other things going on with it. But for the most part, it's been fairly good, and we've been able to do some good imaging. And they're not the, you know, this system can only do so much. It's not going to create the prettiest pictures like some of these other modern systems will. But it's mostly more for science type stuff. The goal for the MSRO is to teach people how to use systems and to do science and to bring kids along into the realm of astronomy and what's involved with doing astrophotography. So it's a good training system in that regard. But we've done deep sky objects, a lot of deep sky objects. I've done some asteroid work and a little bit of lunar work. We do have one member of our club that's, his name's Bart Ballard. He's into occultations, and he's got a system that we attach to the scope, and he's done some interesting occultations. He just recently did the Aldebaran did a grazing occultation of the moon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice.
And he got some good data on that, which is pretty cool with our system.
Now, you have a modest gallery up for public viewing at the Rappahannock Astronomy Club's website, right?
Yeah, that's pretty old stuff. That was, if you look at that, that's from like 2010, 2011.
Mm-hmm. Mostly lunar, some minor planets.
Yeah, it's different things. That's when I was first getting started. That's before I even thought about writing a book.
Do you have a more recent gallery that
accessible? I did have one on PBase, but it went away. I don't really have anything with my recent work. Unfortunately, over the last two years, basically, I haven't done a huge amount of work other than just asteroid work and some miscellaneous stuff. I've gone to a lot of outreach events and stuff. So I've kind of, the bulk of my observing was done back between 2009, or photography, I guess I should say, between 2009 in 2013, 2012, 2013, 14, a little bit. But since then, I really haven't been that active, which kind of grates on me a little bit. You know, I'm working professionally in the astronomy business now. I retired from my day job, although I'm working there part-time again for consulting. But I was a nuclear instrumentation controls engineer and that 30 some years with the nuclear utility here in Virginia. So since I moved over to the astronomy business, I haven't had a lot of time to do all the stuff I'd like to do. But I've got some ideas and I've got some things I'm going to be moving, you know, doing as soon as we get the MSRO working very reliably.
So you'll be doing photography, position work, some photometry work.
Yep.
And,
I'd like to get into light curve work for asteroid light curve work. And then, of course, monitoring the near-Earth asteroids that pop out of nowhere, you know.
We just had one flying by today, actually. What was it? Where's that list of near-Earth asteroids? There we go. We got one that was about 50 feet across, and it only went by at 50,000 miles, 2/10 of the distance to the moon. That was just today.
Close one.
But even at that size and distance, too small to see.
Yep.
Yeah, that's, when was it? I think it was in 2012. I can't remember. There was one that I monitored that was going, one of the first ones, the nearest ones that I did, 2011, I think it was. And it was on 9/11, actually, 2011. I was up early in the morning tracking this thing go fly by, and it was just amazing to watch it walk across the screen when I was taking image after image. And I could only take like 20 seconds images because it was moving so fast. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to measure the position accurately.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of a blob or a line even. If you took a one-minute exposure on this thing, it would be an oblong, like almost a line, because it was moving so fast over a one-minute period. And I don't recall what the designator for that minor planet was, but it was passing. I don't think it passed inside the orbit of the moon, but it was pretty close.
There's been some fun ones that have gone by pretty close. I mean, half milers in diameter and passing, you know, within a few tens of thousands of miles from the Earth. Those are fun ones to watch.
It's amazing that we can detect. Well, it's late in the game when we detect them, of course, because they're so small. But it's kind of cool that we can find these little rocks that are like 200 feet in diameter
and
coming at us.
And scary when we do find them, and like, oh, we didn't see that yesterday, but
right,
today it was closest approach. How did that happen? So upcoming projects.
I'm actually working on some new hardware design for some, like I said before, Explore Scientific. We're trying to push down the technology into the lower end mouth. We're running into, you know, it's one thing to get the price down and get the, you know, get the capabilities and functions integrated into a small device that's cheap enough to sell with beginning scopes. But then you run into mechanical issues. You know, you don't spend the money on the mechanics. It doesn't matter how good your electronics are.
Yes.
So you start running into those issues, you know, when you get down below $500. You know, get to around $300 or so. So that's the task that I've been given, is to work on pushing the technology down. We're trying to be as innovative as we can and be able to share the technology as much as we can to get people interested and started in this hobby. And I think that's part of the, you know, the issues we're running into as a as an overall view of the hobby. You know, us older fellas and women can afford this stuff because we've worked our careers and we're near retirement or whatever. We've got disposable income to spend, you know, good amount of money on stuff. But then we want people to get started when they're teenagers or, you know, first starting out in their careers, and they can't spend $2,000, $3,000 on equipment just to learn about it.
Right.
You know, and then, you know, feel like, oh, well, I'm done with that because I can't buy anything better. You know what I mean? It's like my first book's all about learning the skills and knowledge, how to use the equipment, and then know when to upgrade. But if you can't afford to upgrade, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be frustrated with your equipment. So,
yeah, the price point is definitely a challenge, especially as you pointed out, many people starting out, they don't have a lot of disposable income.
So, but you need to give them a taste of what's available. So that's why these commercial remote observatory systems are coming about, because people want to get their feet wet in using the technology, but not necessarily own it. And that's part of the goal for the MSRO, for the Mark Slade Remote Observatory, is to share the technology and train people on there without them having to spend any money on it at all, basically.
And make it a quick learning curve, too.
Well, that's another way. You know, I don't know how quick any of it is. You really want to get good.
For me, there's no quick learning curve on anything.
Yeah. I've been at this for quite a few years, and I'm still learning stuff.
Mm-hmm. Still trying to figure out our own observatory. Getting there, but it's slow.
Well, I'd like to see what you're doing there. That'd be cool.
All right. Well, get some stuff put together and show you what we got there sometime. I'll send you some pictures and stuff.
Okay, great.
Well, you got just a couple more minutes to go here. Let's give you a little bit of quick news stuff in the sky. Don't forget, go to the AAVSO, American Association of Variable Star Observers, and their alert notices. They need observations of three different nova in the Sagittarius-Scorpius region. So check that out. That stuff's kind of getting low on the horizon. Of course, we've got moon and planets are all over the place. You can check that out on the U.S. Naval Observatory's Astronomical Almanac Online. A lot of planets out there. I was just going across the sky with my star chart. We've got, in the evening, we got Saturn and Venus. Then we got Mars and Pluto's there. Then we got Neptune and Uranus, and the Pallas asteroid is out there. Lots of stuff to do, some observing. Thin crescent moon out there, real nice tonight too, so I hope you get a chance to check that out. Getting down to our last seconds here, so I want to thank our guest Jerry Hubble for joining us tonight. Really appreciate you being here.
Yeah, indeed.
Thanks for the invite, I appreciate it. I'd love to come back and talk some more.
Anytime you want to, just let me know and we'll get you on here. Does that sound good?
It sounds good. I hope everybody enjoyed what I had to say tonight. And if you have any questions, I guess I don't know how the best way to contact me. I guess you can call Explore Scientific, or contact me at jrh@explorescientific.com. That's probably the best way.
All right, I'll get you there. Well, we're out of time, so
the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the news talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
AFM.